finally, just a couple of words on how this stuff works out in our dependencies. Sometimes it's described with considerable candor. Actually, one of the clearest voices these days is a former Reaganite insider, a man named Thomas Carruthers, who was part of the democracy enhancement programs, as they were called, within the State Department in the 1980s. These were hailed with great pride. That makes us, you know, the beacon of the future and all that sort of business. He's written a book and a couple articles about this, and they're informative and honest, rather rueful. He says that the policies were sincere, but he thinks they failed. On the contrary, in my opinion, they succeeded quite brilliantly. But putting aside that judgment, what he describes is entirely accurate. It's just interesting to have it said from the inside, you know. He points out that there was a correlation between democracy in the hemisphere and U.S. influence, namely a negative correlation. Where U.S. influence was least, the steps toward democracy were greatest, primarily in the southern cone of Latin America. Whereas, he points out, speaking from the inside, the Reagan administration strongly opposed the moves towards democracy, tried to back the autocratic governments, which are in fact a residue of the Kennedy liberals, I should say, who were very close to the Reaganites in their picture of the world, remarkably close. The Reagan administration sought to preserve these kind of neo-Nazi states of the Southern Cone, but they failed and there was a democracy. And then, of course, they took credit for what had happened afterwards. That, in fact, happened all over the place. Where U.S. influence was the greatest in Central America and the Caribbean, the effects were worst. He recognizes that, doesn't draw any conclusions from it, but in fact it's something that generalizes on human rights as well. Another one of those lessons you're not supposed to learn. He then points out what happened. Here's his description from the inside. Washington's, which he opposes, and so I think it's a bad thing, you know, but he says, Washington sought only limited top-down forms of democratic change that did not risk upsetting the traditional structures of power with which the United States has long been allied. It sought to maintain the basic order of quite undemocratic societies because of the deep fear of populist-based change with all its implications for upsetting established economic and political orders and heading off in a leftist direction. Well, what's a leftist direction? That's a direction that holds, quote some leftist extremists, that holds that the mass of mankind has not been born with saddles on their backs, nor a favored few booted and spurred, ready to ride them. It is the view that should oppose a single and splendid government founded on banking institutions and moneyed in corporations. I'm quoting that leftist extremist Thomas Jefferson in the early days of the corporate state capitalist absolutism that he despised and feared and that has come into existence. Well, Carruthers is quite correct. His picture of what happened is accurate, generalizes very broadly, applies at home as well. It's the key to understanding policy. Again, these are truths that would be taught in elementary school in a free society. Major efforts have to be made in the educational system, right up to the elite universities, to prevent people from seeing that 2 + 2 = 4, but that's the answer. It does. And it's not very hard to figure out. If you look not even very profoundly, you see it all over the place, and it's quite systematic. The policy is that the traditional structures of power must remain, and they have to be protected, in his words, from the populist-based changes. That's true abroad, and that's true at home. Democracy is a fine thing, but only if it has the right outcome. Democracy is defined not by process, but by outcome. The right guys have to win, otherwise it's not democracy. The right guys mean Thomas Jefferson's banking institutions and moneyed in corporations and their modern inheritors and the aristocracy of intellect and character that serves them and labors to conceal the reality of the world from the rascal multitude. People like you, if you get properly trained, I mean, you have to be willing to accept the training, of course. And if you do, a lot of privilege and power comes with that submission to power. So, you know, advantages. Well, we can see the Thomas Carruthers' thesis of the 1980s, which is just history, you know, it's just a chapter of history. We can see it right before our eyes today. In fact, it's playing itself out with really brilliant clarity right in front of us in Haiti. It couldn't be a clearer example. In Haiti, the United States made a mistake. We'd been supporting dictators and murderers and everything. It was all great, but there was a mistake. They allowed a free election. It was assumed that the U.S.-backed candidate, a World Bank official, would win easily at all the resources and so on. But unknown to the men of best quality there and here, there had been a lot of ferment in Haiti. There's a lot of popular organizing. Big popular organizations had developed with nobody paying attention to them. They'd been very effective. And in fact, the wrong guy won with an overwhelming majority in the first free election in the history of the country, namely President Aristide with 2/3 of the vote. Trouble is, it was the wrong 2/3 of the population. As it was described by America's Watch, the leading human rights group, he was swept into power by a remarkably advanced array of popular organizations that gave the vast majority of the population a share in local and national politics. Totally the wrong thing. Completely wrong from every point of view. Well, he was quickly overthrown by violence, and that was an end to Haiti's democracy, or as the New York Times put it in a headline, right afterwards, Haiti's democracy such as it was. That contemptuous comment means not much, you know. We read regularly that President Aristide, not just symbolically, means the rabble that voted for him. President Aristide has meager democratic credentials. He is opposed by what the New York Times calls civil society, which fears that he supports class-based violence. He even blamed the rich for the poverty of the masses. It's an absolute outrage to tell the elementary truths in public here. Maybe in secret somewhere, but, you know, not in public. That happens to be the New York Times, but, you know, it's standard. Again, pick it, you know, pick at random, that's the story. So, therefore, Aristide must broaden his government. That's the current phrase. Unlike Clinton, say, you know, whose government is broad enough, just sort of take a look at the average income in his cabinet. So that's broad enough, but Aristide must broaden his cabinet. That's a code word, which everyone understands. It means he must broaden his cabinet to exclude the huge mass of the population, because they don't belong there. And he must extend it to the democratic elements, what are called the moderates in the military and the business community. Power has to be shifted into their hands. Who are the moderates? Well, the moderates are the ones who don't think everyone should just be exterminated. That's why they're moderates. Rather, they think that people should be allowed to work for 14 cents an hour in U.S.-owned assembly plants, which incidentally is a very useful weapon against poor people at home and working people at home. It's a way to lower standards of living and wages throughout the world, and the rich societies, extremely important thing, so that's the moderates. Also, they're allowed to produce food for export. Right now, under Clinton, though I haven't seen any headlines about it, food exports from Haiti are increasing. This is a starving country, remember. Food exports are increasing, not by a small factor. They increased by a factor of 36 last year. You know, 30, big number under Clinton, thanks to the liberal Democrats. That's fruits, nuts, citizens, melons from a starving island. That's for the benefit of U.S. agribusiness and yuppie markets. In fact, all trade with Haiti is increasing rather substantially under what is laughably called an embargo. The reason is because the embargo has an exception. It has an exception for U.S.-owned assembly plants. And when that's mentioned, it's always explained as a humanitarian gesture. You have to understand that Haitians suffer only when U.S.-owned plants don't export and import. When others don't export and import, they don't suffer. And also, like children in Cuba, fortunately, they don't suffer when they starve, so we don't have to worry about embargoes there. But we have to have a very carefully crafted embargo in Haiti, which excludes U.S.-owned assembly plants, whose trade is increasing. In fact, total trade is increasing, which allows export of food, which doesn't happen to notice that the Dominican border is completely porous, so the rich can get anything they feel like. You know, the U.S. is totally impotent to stop the Dominican, control the Dominican army, which it runs, you know, like, I mean, you know, the United States is known for having been able to exert influence at places, but you know, not over superpower like the Dominican Republic, so we can't do anything about that. The Haitian military, as everyone knows, lives primarily on narco-trafficking. Take a look. The U.S. Navy and Coast Guard have been able to pick up just about every fishing boat that escapes Haiti with some terrified refugees. That's a totally illegal blockade, incidentally. It's as if Libya, say, were to block all commercial air traffic out of the United States. But we're a terrorist state, so we do what we feel like. But we've been able to pick up every refugee just about, but not a single narco-trafficking boat. Amazing, isn't it? Actually, this was asked by the Black Caucus and John Conyers. Now, they got an answer. They said the problem in stopping narco-trafficking in Haiti is that the Haitian military, who we work with, and still work with, don't have radar. So they can't pick up the planes and the boats. And, of course, the U.S. Navy and Air Force, because of these terrible Pentagon budget cuts, you know, they can't figure out a way to remedy this deficiency. So therefore, we just, you know, what can we do? I mean, we'd like to stop it, but we can't. All this is going on. And the end result is perfectly predictable, and it has been predictable from the beginning. And for example, it was predictable when Warren Christopher, the Secretary of State, had his confirmation hearings. He was asked, if you looked at the small print, he was asked, what do you think about Haiti? New liberal Democrats coming in. And he said, we think that President Aristide definitely has a place in the final settlement, though we haven't quite determined yet what that place is. And with that ringing endorsement of democracy, the Clinton administration took over and has succeeded in harshening the policies of the Bush administration, which it attacked, including what I've just described. The end result is supposed to be that the government is to be broadened to include the moderates of the kind that I described. Aristide either doesn't get back at all or maybe gets back and has a kind of symbolic presence, which means that the population has a symbolic presence. Meanwhile, the population gets terrorized and intimidated. A year ago, when the America's Watch report came out, they pointed out already, beginning in the Clinton term, that if this goes on, it won't matter much whether Aristide gets back or not. The popular organizations will have been decimated. People will be intimidated and terrified. And then you can even run a vote, like the way we're doing in El Salvador. And then it'll be fine. You know, if you intimidate and demoralize people enough, if you crush them, if you eliminate any hope, if you make it clear to them that if they get out of line, they're going to be slaughtered, then you can even run an election. And all the, you know, you'll get Anthony Lewis to talk about this romantic era, you know, like Thomas Jefferson, as he did after we succeeded in doing precisely that in Nicaragua. That's called democracy. And we're now watching it play out before our eyes in the case of Haiti.